Hey, folks, before we get into things, I just wanted to mention, maybe this is your first time listening to Sonatotum. Maybe you've come here to hear the conversation with AJ Super that's coming up in just a few minutes. If you like what you hear, please take a moment to subscribe to Sonatotum with Matthew Wayne Selznick, wherever it is that you get your podcasts, wherever it is that you're probably listening to this right now. Just hit that subscribe button. And also, if you enjoy the conversation that's about to happen, then I hope you'll take a moment to rate and review Sonatotum. Again, wherever it is that you're listening to this show, be that Apple Podcasts or Spotify or even YouTube, a rating and review goes a long way to helping boost the popularity and so the audience and so the reach of this show so that more people can hear conversations like you're about to hear with AJ Super. Thanks. Let's get into it. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick, and this is Sonatotum, episode 101. Hello, my friends. On this and every episode of Sonatotum, we talk about making stuff, mostly writing, finding success as we each define it for ourselves, and staying healthy and sane in the process. Well, who am I to be talking to you about such things? I have been an independent creator for, pert near 30 years, an independent publisher since 1999 with one of the first webzines, or 2005 with the first novel in history, with a simultaneous release in paperback, ebook, and podcast formats. It is not my first rodeo when it comes to self-publishing and living a creative writing life, but as I like to say, the venues keep changing, the horses keep changing, the bulls keep changing, and especially the clowns keep changing. So I try to approach things with an air of an experienced beginner. On every other episode of Sonatotum, I talk to another writer, poet, playwright, novelist, what have you, and we have an in-depth conversation about the three tentpoles of the show: making stuff, finding success, staying healthy and sane. And that's what this episode is all about. My guest today is AJ Super. They are the author of the Seven Stars Saga, a trilogy published by Athon Books and Blackstone Audio. They earned two bachelor degrees, one in creative writing and the other in theater stage management and directing. Now writing full-time, they've been an author since they were old enough to write and illustrate a stapled together ABC book. AJ is inspired by Ursula K. Le Guin, Anne McCaffrey, Octavia Butler, Mercedes Lackey, and other amazing female science fiction and fantasy authors. They are active in several different writing communities and are, as am I, an active SFWA, Science Fiction Writers Association, member. They currently live in the mountains of central Idaho with their fuzz-brained kitties and supportive spouse. Now, that all comes from their website, where you can find everything there is to know about AJ Super at ajsuper.com. Let's get into my conversation with AJ Super. AJ Super, what do you create?
Words. I make lots of words. Seriously, though, I am an author almost exclusively of science fiction at this point. Well, unless you count my Patreon, where I put up poetry, flash, short fic, things that I dabble in, which range from literary and spec fic to a little like light sci-fi kind of thing. And I do experiment with YA horror. I have something I've been drafting in between science fiction novels, but those are really all just kind of for fun and for experimentation. I consider myself mostly a science fiction author because that's what I tend to finish and home. I've got a published trilogy, The Seven Star Saga, and it's by Small Press. I debuted in 2021 with the first, Erebus Dawning, which followed quickly with the second book, Star Reborn. It was supposed to be a quick release schedule, but between COVID and its resultant mental pressures, health issues, discovering that my mental health diagnoses were more serious than thought, and just really overall burnout from trying to do a 9-month publishing schedule for a whole trilogy. Mm-hmm. I didn't get Queen of the Black out until September 2023 with Aethon.
Which is still, that's still a, you know, a book a year is, that's the, yeah. Most people would consider that, you know, about right.
But yeah, yeah, no, and when it's, I have learned that getting 2 books out in a 6-month period and trying to get that third one out in the 9-month kind of frame, that's just doesn't work for me. Yeah. I like writing a book a year, and spending the time I spent on Queen of the Black was totally worth the missing of deadline after deadline, and and my publisher was really, really supportive, even though they weren't really supportive. Like, they were okay with me missing deadlines. They would rather me have a quality product,
sure.
a good book, and they would rather me be healthy, which I love about them, but they really didn't support my books marketing wise. So a little bit for the first book, but the second book and the third book, none. That was really disappointing.
I want to get into some of that process and some of that marketing stuff in a bit, but the thing that I always ask, the thing that I'm always curious about, kind of the meat and potatoes, we know what you create, but the in the spirit of a 3 or a 4 year old, but why? Why do you create?
Yeah, this is one of the reasons I don't have kids. I hate whys.
Because there's always another why, right?
Yeah.
Have you considered it? What is it that drives you to write?
Most authors, whether they are the beginning or whether they are pros, always get asked this question. And Flannery O'Connor, I think, said it best when asked, why do you write? I'm good at it. Like, I enjoy writing. It's something I'm not terrible at, and it's really that simple. But if you were to ask me why I write sci-fi, I would answer more like Octavia Butler. She has this quote that I love that goes something like, science fiction is so wide open, you can do anything with no walls to hem you in, and there's no human condition that you can't examine. Science fiction is freeing so that you can go any place and examine anything. And I love that freedom to explore and answer questions that intrigue me about my running themes in my book right now are power, corruption, identity, family, and how those intertwine in the mirror of possibility that science fiction provides. And that's why I write science fiction. I love that feeling of freedom to be able to explore.
And why do you think that's important to you?
Honestly, I grew up pretty sheltered, and my parents are wonderful. I love my parents, but I, as a result, turned into the people-pleasing person. And I want more freedom than having to please everyone around me, right? So exploring how I feel about the world around me through these themes, just it makes me feel like I'm soaring in a way. Mm. It's, yeah. I'm getting a little, I don't know, pedantic and existential in a way, I guess.
No, that's the whole point of this show. Yeah, no, go as deep. Go seriously, go as deep as you want.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. I really did like the idea of this show when I sent you my first email, to be able to be honest and open and talk about creation and process, and like even simple things like, why do I write?
Oh, yeah, because it's not simple.
And it's, well, it is for me because I'm good at it, really. Flannery O'Connor had it totally right. Like, if you're good at it, do it.
Well, and sure, but you had to discover that you were good at it, and something drove you to go down that path. I mean, you could have tried painting and discovered you were good at that, or, you know.
Yeah, I totally get that. My dad is quite the storyteller, actually. And I kind of got it from him. I started writing when I was like knee-high to a grasshopper.
Mm-hmm.
And I published my first little kind of book. It was an ABC book with illustrations that I copied and stapled, and my distribution was like handing it to my parents and telling them to give it to family.
Mm-hmm.
which really hasn't changed much. but, you know, after that, I started writing like R.L. Stein style MG horror, YA kind of young adult horror stories.
Mm-hmm.
And scripts for plays for my cousins to perform at family events.
And what ages were you when you were doing these things?
Oh gosh. My first ABC book had to be when I was like 5 or 6.
Uh-huh.
And then throughout childhood, I was always writing stories of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
At some point in middle school, my mom read one and she was like, "Is this how you see your sister?" Because it was about two sisters that fight a lot and didn't like each other. And I mean, simple things in childhood. I was like, no, I'm just writing a story. It's just a story about these two people who go through the process of learning to love each other. I guess you could say that it was a little bit about my sister, because I love my sister and we fight and, you know, as families do. Mm-hmm. And we come back together, and that's kind of what the story was about. But I didn't know that when I was like 12.
Right. Well, yeah. That's, I think that's so true. I mean, in some ways, I think a lot of us are, you know, writing for discovery, you know, figuring out what it is that we're actually thinking, talking about, feeling, experiencing.
And yeah, that's so true of like childhood writing too. Mm-hmm. Like, especially when you hit high school in the emo poetry phase.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
Oh no, of course not. I don't know any author that hasn't gone through the emo poetry phase. Even my husband, spouse, partner person, he went through an emo poetry phase, and he's a photographer.
Yep. Sure.
Like, it's an art thing, I think, to explore how you feel about the world around you. Gee, mm-hmm. Theme of the night, I guess.
And when did science fiction start entering into it?
Well, I tried to write this horrible Star Wars fanfic of the let's see if I can remember the book. It's the New Jedi Order, I believe. It's about Jason Solo, and I think it was called Traitor. But it was terrible. Like, I failed miserably writing whatever the heck that was. And I didn't do anything with it at all. It's like laying in a notebook somewhere in my writing room. So maybe one day I'll revisit and see if there's any good nuggets. But
scrape the serial numbers off of it. And yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
How old were you when that was?
I was early in college, so probably 19 or 20.
Mm-hmm.
trying to do something a little different with my writing. I took a lot of creative writing classes. That's one of my degrees, is creative writing. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a lot of experimental stuff that verged on spec fic that wasn't really spec fic, but I tried to do literary fiction in a spec fic way. It was really kind of confused and didn't have a point. But welcome to learning how to write.
Sure.
Right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's all of that. The terrible teen poetry and emulating other stories, you know, whether it's fan fiction or mashups or whatever. I mean, I think we can all relate to that. I have a manila envelope of 400 bad poems, all written in a purple pen, all done very ritualistically, listening to a particular DJ between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. at night. and then, yeah, I'm in my mid 50s, so my first stories were typed out on the manual typewriter that I'd inherited from my grandfather, you know, on onion skin with carbon paper in between, and stories based on songs on the radio, or what, we didn't even have a name for it as fan fiction back then, but, you know, stories featuring Marvel Comics characters, or this mashup of H.P. Lovecraft and X-Men that I did, and it's all in there, and, you know, going through the emulating the serious stuff, you know, my Raymond Carver knockoffs and my Charles Bukowski knockoffs. And
I have Charles Bukowski knockoffs too.
I mean, honestly, the name of this show and the name of my blog, Scrib Totem, is because Factotum is one of my favorite books by Bukowski.
I was going to say, I haven't read Bukowski since my emo high school days. So that's been like 20 plus years. Oh my goodness.
Factotum is very, I mean, they're all autobiographical, right? If you remember his stuff, but
yeah,
but it's that and Post Office are less, there's a lot of stuff in there about trying to, you know, being incredibly dedicated to the writing craft and giving up things for it, and his childhood and all of that. And yeah, definitely had an influence on me at one point, for sure.
Yeah. I was more into the poetry. So, what was it?
Love is a Dog from Hell, right?
Yeah, that's exactly. There we go. It was that one. And The Days Run Away Like Wild Horses Over the Hills.
Yeah, yeah.
The early stuff. Like, mm-hmm. I would find used books at the bookstore here. Well, sure. before the used bookstore closed, of course.
Of course.
The sadness that happens with things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I have great memories of being in the bookstore looking for random books, poetry collections, and I live in an area that basically idolizes Hemingway, so I've read a lot of Hemingway.
Okay, yeah.
So there was the Hemingway searches as well. I live in Sun Valley, Idaho, where he spent a lot of time writing.
I see.
So, his grave is even here.
Ah, so there's the pilgrimages and the annual festival. Yes. And the, yeah.
there is absolutely all of that. And I'm not, and looking back, I'm like, I don't know why I really liked Hemingway at that point in my life, other than it's kind of emo.
Oh, for sure.
So
yeah,
and it fit my aesthetic at the time, and now I'm like, oh, drunken misogyny, just like Bukowski.
And the thing is, I guess, is that if you kind of like peer through that, there's the tragic, tragic vulnerability, you know? But yeah, it's definitely, you know, it can be a difficult read for some folks, Hemingway and Bukowski and heck, so many.
Honestly, especially from that period of time in writing.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm rereading Julian May right now, which this is going to tie together. In particular, her saga of Pliocene Exile and the Galactic Milieu books. And these were written, I'm not sure if you're familiar, these were written in the early, late 70s through the mid 80s. And they're taken together. One is a four volume series and the other is three or four volumes, depending on how you count. Taken together, they're this huge, long science fiction family saga. Brilliantly written, but they are of their time. You know, referring to Asians as Orientals is a common example within it. And rereading them now and remembering like what a sort of like, I don't know if you have authors like this, they're sort of secret influences that you kind of forgot about. And when you go back, you're like, oh, I totally got this, that, and the other thing that I'm always exploring or using in my work. That's from these guys. But rereading her now, I had to think, you know, it's kind of a shame. I don't know if folks would get too far through this before they were, you know, made to feel uncomfortable. But and it's the same thing with like rereading Edgar Rice Burroughs or Sax Rohmer or, you know, any of that. It's it works maybe getting lost because of the standard with which they were written at the time, you know, and this is how it ties in with Bukowski and I'm thinking of why am I blanking on the author of The Great Gatsby?
My spouse and I were just talking about that because that was one of the few F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Right, Fitzgerald. Yeah.
Fitzgerald. Yeah. That's one of the few books that he actually was able to read. He's got severe ADHD, mm-hmm. and so reading is really hard for him. Because his attention span is very short, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I get that. I'm a slow reader as a result of ADHD as well. There are just so many things going on and my brain connects things in books and I go, oh yeah, I forgot that I needed to go do this because somebody in the book is,
doing laundry, their oil changed. Yeah. And
yeah, exactly. doing laundry, getting their oil changed. Most of the books that I read aren't that mundane, but for whatever reason, my brain makes those connections and it makes it hard to read quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And the same goes for, Josh, my partner. He just, you know, I love him to death. I started writing full time, because he supported me. But the books that I started writing, I wrote because I wanted him to be able to get through them. So the pacing is really fast. There's always something going on. And it's a challenge for me to write for somebody who is a hard reader.
Mm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he's read all, he's my alpha reader now.
Yeah.
And he's read all of my books multiple times, like beyond multiple times, dozens. And he's amazing and I love him. And, if I can keep his attention, then I should be able to keep just about anyone's attention is how I feel about my books.
Right. That's lovely. Actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
Having that kind of, and I'm guessing that even though your mother was a little concerned about that one book about the sisters, I'm guessing that you had that same kind of support and encouragement.
Yeah. And my dad is kind of the stoic cowboy type. And I got a, I'm very proud of you. You're doing things that are scary, that scare me, and you're doing well at them. And that's amazing.
That's
and
high praise.
That's more than high praise. That's like, that floored me. He doesn't say more than a couple of sentences generally about anything that he likes. And his go-to for something he likes is, yeah, let's do that again. And that's it.
And I'll bet he very carefully considered the words that he was going to use to tell you those things.
I think he did. Yeah. He's, you know, as a storyteller, he's pretty thoughtful. Mm-hmm. And he knows words. He doesn't write them down, but he's a great verbal storyteller, and he did a decent job raising another storyteller, I guess.
That's right. So. Well, this is kind of a gentle segue into the next sort of tentpole of the show, which is, as a writer, as an author, how do you define success, and how's it going? Where are you on that spectrum? On that path?
So I have a very complicated relationship with the idea of success.
Lay it on me.
My dad, his degree is in economics. He's an economist. He knows how, like, capitalism and all that works, and late stage capitalism, and how it's going to all fall apart. And he's pretty good at predicting things that are going to happen in the economy. Mm-hmm. So success for him, as instilled in me, because he is a man of capitalism, basically, is that I make money. And the thing is I really don't make money. Through a small press, not a lot of marketing, not a lot of PR. I get enough to buy myself and my partner dinner every 4 months.
Right.
At first, it was a little bit more. It's kind of tapered off. So I can't hinge my definition of success on making money, because I don't right now. I may eventually. I'm looking at self-publishing in the future. I'm looking at, like, all sorts of other options for stuff. I may make more money in the future. But if I hinge my definition of success on money, I'm never going to feel completed, I guess. Right. You could say.
Sure.
Right? So what I call successful is finishing something. Mm-hmm. I finish a manuscript. That is success for me, because that means I've got something that I can maybe sell, right? If I go on to maybe eventually publish it or get an agent with it, then those things are like the icing and the candles and the sprinkles on the cake. It's the actual cake is the manuscript itself.
Yeah.
Nothing can happen without that. So having a finished product that I can maybe in the future make money with is my idea of being a successful author. Mm-hmm. Finishing and authoring a completed manuscript. And I love it. Like, I love, I know I'm a slow writer. I only write about one and a half books a year. And I love the process of doing that. I love drafting. I love editing. I love going through and talking about my book with my alpha readers and my beta readers and my critique partners. I love just every single step. But success is when I have completed all that editing and all of that talking, and I finally have something that I can, you know, maybe move on with. And mm-hmm. if I can't, which, like every author, I have stuff that I can't do anything with, I you know, I'm okay with it because I have completed something.
Right. Right. And presumably learned something from that.
You know? Absolutely. Like, yeah. How can you not write a book right. without learning something new every time?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because I do hear, I won't call it pushback, but I hear an opposite view now and then where, as a specific example, I remember just sort of venting one day on some writing group on Facebook, or, you know, I don't even remember which group it was. But I think all I posted was, writing is hard. and it ended up becoming this discussion of, like, almost immediately somebody commented with, you know, if you're not enjoying it, your readers aren't going to enjoy it either. I'm like, well, I didn't, okay. Number one, I didn't say I wasn't enjoying it. and number two, I call shenanigans on that whole idea.
yeah, because at some point every author goes through the, oh my gosh, this sucks and I hate it and I'm not enjoying it anymore stage.
Well, that's just it. And I think what it came down to, what developed out of that discussion is authors were coming out of the woodwork who did not feel that way. They felt completely, you know, content and satisfied and happy with every single book they wrote, present, past, and you know, whatever. And I realized that it's because they weren't actually challenging themselves. They were, and there's a place for this, for readers, for writers. I'm not judging this, but they were, they figured out what works, they figured out what sells, and that's what they do. And I could never be satisfied with that.
No, I'd find that boring.
Yeah.
Like, the whole point of being a human being is challenging yourself.
And who knows, maybe they challenge themselves in other ways.
Maybe. I mean, I could give that to them, but I would find that process of writing just dull as a doorknob.
Yeah. It, you know, I don't want to have it be something I do by rote, you know, pun intended. you know, yeah, I can relate to your idea of success being just getting to done, and all of the experience and not just experience, but expertise and growth that comes in that process. I can dig it for sure.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And I didn't even think about all the challenge and growth and experience that you get with each project. And that is part of why I judge success on the completion of a story for myself. Mm-hmm. Like, somebody else's definition of success is going to be completely different than mine, obviously.
Yeah, sure.
So no judgment on that. But for me, like, going through that process and exploring and finding new things that I want to emphasize and research and just kind of dig my teeth into, right?
Right. Well, that freedom to explore that you mentioned earlier, and the
exactly, it's that freedom to explore, and that comes with an end result of completing a manuscript, and that for me is success.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned loving the process. I know you don't just write novels. You mentioned all kinds of different things, but have you? And also recognizing that this is refined and adjusted as applicable for each project. But have you kind of settled in on, okay, this, at least this basic structural rhythm works for me, or is every book like, okay, I don't know.
Oh no. Oh my goodness. It's okay. I don't know, because, you know, I am the weirdo who decided to discovery write an entire trilogy.
Youch.
I don't suggest it. The threads that you have to keep in your brain for like three books that you eventually have to like tie off, there's just too many. Like, I didn't even write them down. I just went, oh, I forgot this thread. And I'd go back 50 pages and put more work in. And mm-hmm. then, oh, I forgot this one. Go back 50 pages again, put more work in. And it worked for me. I think I got a really good product, I guess you could say. See, this is my capitalist father. It's a product. It's not a book. It's not a piece of art. It's a product.
I mean, it can be all of those things at once.
Yeah, it can, but I'm trying to change that paradigm of how I think. Like, my manuscripts are novels. They're books. They're art. They're not just something to sell. Because, you know, if I do it just to sell, then I'd be writing by rote. And it's really funny, though, because this project that I'm working on right now, this a work in progress, is the first time I have ever in my life like scripted out kind of a plan. I got like the major events kind of notated down in a like a hero's journey kind of structure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going well for me because I left a lot of room to continue to discovery write in between those moments.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah.
So
kind of a hybrid approach.
I think some people call it plantsing.
Right.
Like you're a planter or a pantser and it turns into a bush. I have no idea.
Well, I don't remember where I first heard this described, but I completely agree with it. Whether we discovery write or plan it out ahead of time, ultimately everybody's a planner. It's the same amount of thinking and work. It's just whether it's front loaded or not. You know, because like me, on anything larger than a short story, unless the short story is very plot driven, anything larger than a short story, I'm going to work things out to the beat level. I'm going to have in-depth character biographies and character studies, and it can be tens of thousands of words before the manuscript writing begins. But on the other hand, somebody else might end up writing 3-4 drafts, you know, like you said, going back 50 pages and adding something and going back, oh God, I have to add this in. To me, when it comes to novels, well, anything above, like, you know, like I said, above short story level, that front loading saves me. I can get a really clean first draft, you know, because I've kind of done all the thinky bits.
Yeah.
And when I'm typing, I can focus on the craft and the dialogue and all that stuff. But that's really, in a way, it's not much different from, you know, just throwing that stuff in after the fact and working it out. You know, is it an extra 20,000 words in prep, or is it an extra 20,000 words that gets thrown away by the fourth draft? You know, it's
it's one or the other, right?
Yeah. And in the end, it probably amounts to the same amount of time. You know, there are some hardcore outliners that I've spoken to. I mean, even just anecdotally, I don't mean just on the show, but who will swear that, you know, they've got their system and it's what allows them to write 4, 5, 6 books a year, and not pulpy, you know, by the numbers type stuff. But yeah, there's no one way, right? And
no, there's not. And I really dislike it when people put out like on social media some sort of prescriptive. You have to do it this way because mm-hmm. this is the rule. And the thing is, as I remind myself constantly, writing is an art, right? It's not a science.
Sure.
And you can have, quote, formulas and whatever for your process. But, you know, I know artists, visual artists that have formulas for their process as well. Mm-hmm. It's still art.
That's right. That's right. And I wanted to ask you, I wanted to circle back on that because you mentioned it before, you know, what you do is art. And this is, you know, probably an unfair question. Define art for me.
Oh, my gosh. my partner used to be an art teacher. That's what he asks his students all the time. Art is whatever you think art is. It could be a blank wall that somebody splashed paint on. I don't know. Like, it could be, you know, graffiti. It could be beautifully written prose in a literary novel. It could be, I mean, it's science fiction exploring like unexplored worlds and looking at, I don't know, like looking at the way the world, our world works through an alien planet. Like, that is art. Everything that creators can create, that is art. It's just whether or not you have the eyes to and the heart to see it.
So I agree that it's entirely subjective, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's the cliche. It's in the eye of the beholder.
Yes.
What do you think it is that shapes what each person or how each person defines it for themselves then?
Well, I define it the way I define it as so broad and subjective, because I have a very open heart.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm willing to let somebody's art be what it is, even if I don't necessarily agree with it or like it or whatever. But I am willing to give that art a chance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the ability to give art its own place and its own space to exist, it's for the individual to decide.
Yeah. And I wanted to hear your version, of course, before I you know, opined on it myself. I'm going to put it slightly differently, but I think we're saying the same thing. And the older I get, the more I realize that I kind of, this is sort of my way of doing a lot of things like this. When I start to think about stuff, is kind of really distilling it down to as fundamental a state as I can manage. So the definition of art that I've finally come to is any created thing that elicits an emotional reaction. And that doesn't necessarily have to be a good emotional reaction, but as long as something makes the person experiencing it feel something, and now ideally it is close to or in the neighborhood of what the creator of that thing intended, but not necessarily.
Exactly.
Then sure. Yeah, that's art. And sort of a corollary to that is that it's not art until the creator of that thing allows it to be experienced by others. You know, before then, it's just, it's expression for sure. But if it's not some form of communication, some sort if the opportunity for collaboration between the person who created it and the person experiencing it isn't offered, then it might not be art yet. In other words, it requires participation.
Ah, that's a really interesting way to look at it. Like, I didn't think that far down, but yeah. If it's in the eye of the beholder, then you absolutely have to.
You need a beholder, right?
Yeah. You need a second party. You can't just have a creator creating in isolation. You can. There is actually isolationist art.
Oh, sure.
But then it's shared and no longer in isolation.
Right.
So even art that is created outside of the experience of art, as long as there is somebody participating in that experience,
right,
in the end result, I just didn't even look, mind blown. I didn't think of it that way, but yes, you're absolutely right.
It's part of sort of my overall approach, because my day job is helping writers and other creators make their stuff and get their stuff to out into the world and to have it be experienced by others. And you know, you always hear, you know, how do I build my audience, right? How do I grow my audience? And I've been trying to reframe that. Let's stop thinking about it as an audience. Let's start thinking about it as a community, because of that collaborative necessity, right?
Yeah.
Try to think of, in our case, your readers as peers, as collaborators in the experience, because, and we were just talking about this in the last conversation that I had for the show with another author, is we might try as hard as we can, using the right words in the right order, to elicit a particular response, right? We want to clearly communicate not just what happens, but how we should feel when we read the thing that happens. But we never have complete control over that. We can never guess what that really is going to be until we start hearing from the readers, until that circuit is closed, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's all kind of part of that. And so, yeah, I'm always curious to hear how other creators view just that very fundamental, very fungible, very subjective question of what is art.
I wouldn't have had 3 books published if there weren't, you know, the potential of that creative combination of participant and creator, right?
Elaborate on that.
If my publisher didn't think that I could get readers.
There you go. Right. Yeah. And there's that capitalism back at work. Yeah.
Yay, capitalism. But at the same time, through an art perspective,
yeah,
like if they didn't think that it was artful enough, if they didn't think that the book was good enough, they would never have picked it up.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Right.
And I would never have found those readers, and it would have got shelved for whatever reason. And would it have been art if it would have been shelved? That's a good question.
Yeah. I mean, from my model, it would have been a valid means of expression, but it might not have been art, you know?
Yeah.
Which is, again, it's a valid thing. No one who is creative, and everyone is creative, no one is creative who is creative should feel obligated to share what they want, you know?
Absolutely.
You know, I think when I hear people say, oh, I don't know if I should do this or should do that, my answer is pretty much always yes, because no one else is going to be able to do that creative endeavor in the same way that that person will. And they have no way to predict how what they do, if they do it, will affect others. So in that sense, I do think there's a responsibility, you know, to at least try, you know?
Yeah. And perspective is a powerful thing. Like,
yeah,
what one person writes and you see that, you know, you have the same idea, you're going to write it differently.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I mean. Yeah. And your perception is going to be meaningful to perhaps a different subset of the available pool than the other person who wrote the space opera, you know, fill in the blank, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
The last sort of tentpole tenant of the show is dot, 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 and staying healthy and sane while we do all these things, while we create stuff, while we try to find success, how we define it. Do you have, I mean, and you answer this any way you like, you know, what does it mean to you to stay healthy and sane in the process of pursuing a creative writing life?
That is a really hard question, because honestly, I have yet to figure out the perfect answer for that.
That's okay.
Like, you know, I went through a serious period of burnout after I turned in my third book in the spring of 2023. And it required more self-care for recovery than I really ever want to admit.
Mm.
To be completely frank, it was not even self-care at that point. It was aftercare.
Yeah.
Now, as a result, I'm very particular about how I spend my time. I'm very, I try to be quite a bit more organized. Like, I try to follow a schedule, to be in the habit of working only when I'm in like the right mental health space. Like, if I feel like I can't write for whatever reason, if I have, quote, writer's block, which I don't believe in, I will spend the day cogitating on, you know, whatever problem I'm having. And I spend less time in front of a blank screen, right?
Mm.
If I take that time to, you know, go for a walk or do the dishes or whatever, because I am always thinking about what I'm going to do next in a project that I'm working on. And being very particular about, you know, making sure that I let myself just kind of have the time to be a human being and not someone who constantly produces something, whether it's social media content or, you know, doing PR or marketing, which I don't do a lot of myself, which could be a problem for sales, I think, thinking on it.
There might be a correlation.
Maybe, just just maybe. The thing is, you know, I try to keep my weekends free. I have some hobbies. I like sewing costumes for medieval recreation activity kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I volunteer for my local library, guiding local writers in focused writing groups and critique sessions.
That's
like,
exciting.
I know it's fun. Like, it's fun to teach new writers. It's fun to kind of guide their growth and learn with them. Like, I've learned a lot from these new writers, and I've been working with them since October. It's a very close-knit group at this point, and it's great. But as a result, you know, I am getting out of the house, which I used to not do. I used to just write. My partner was like, you know, you should have something other than just sitting in your chair and writing. And I found a community in the library. I found a community in my medieval recreation, whatever you want to call it, group. That community helps to kind of keep me from burning out now, because I have something else other than, you know, producing something that may or may not sell in the end, right? There's my capitalist dad talking again.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, you could even broaden that out and just think of it in terms of that may not be validated.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And sales, I think, when you start looking at readership and sales and things like that, when you have a finished product, whether you traditionally publish, whether you publish with a small press, whether you self-publish, having that readership and those sales, that is the validation, right? Getting reviews, that is the validation that you did okay.
So before you kind of came to this, like, oh, I need to get some variety, get some external stimulus. Was it just the commitment of the three books? What had driven you to that burnout point?
Well, first I would say never sign a trilogy that comes out one right after the other, one every 3 months, basically.
Right. As you mentioned before.
As much as I love my publisher, that's just too hard on a writer, especially a writer that only does a book a year.
How much of that had been written when you got the deal?
I had one book written and one book in my head. I'd say planned, but it was in my head because I was discovery writing at that point. So,
right.
And I kind of knew the arc that the books would take because it's a villain story kind of thing. It's the origin, it's the villain, and it's what happens to the villain at the end.
So you had one book down and you needed to completely write two more. Yeah, that's
I signed late 2019 and I got my first book turned in during COVID in like mid 2020. After that, it was just like try to write as fast as I can. And I got one book done by the book deadline for the second book. And they were soft deadlines, but they really wanted to do a quick release schedule. And I really wanted to, you know, I was a new author. I wanted to please. And I'm a people pleaser, darn it.
Well, sure. You think this is my shot. Yeah.
So I just pushing to get that second book done, I couldn't imagine getting another book done in 3 months. And I just completely, like, lost the thread of reality. Basically, like, at that point I was starting to get like health problems and then I got a mental health diagnosis that was surprising, but not surprising at the same time. And then it got worse, before it got better. And adding those kind of things into the burnout and the overall, you know, emotional baggage that COVID brought.
Sure.
I just, you know, it took nearly 2 years between the second and third book. And I just, you know, I couldn't handle getting that last book done. So now as a result, I'm a lot better now.
Yeah.
Like, I portion my time out for writing. I portion my time out for friends and doing volunteer work. And I make sure that I am balancing my life. Because when you have weirdness happen in your life, balance is the only thing that can right the ship.
Right? I agree. And it's so... Well, I mean, I'll speak for myself. The trick is figuring out that balance and then, big one, maintaining it.
Yeah, and you have to be able to maintain it in such a way that it's adaptable. Because, you know, something that works one day might not work the next day, at least for me.
No, I agree.
And if it doesn't work the next day, then I have to kind of find something to shoehorn in until I find something that does work again.
And not feel anxious or guilty about, oh, I'm not doing... the system.
Exactly. And, you know, when I first started writing, I was all about, you know, writing 4 hours a day, then doing an hour of yoga and, eating well and, you know, doing all of this stuff. And it worked for me then, but it doesn't anymore. I mean, of course I take care of myself and I eat well and whatnot, but I don't have the time to spend an hour a day doing yoga.
Right.
So maybe I'll go for a 15-minute walk, or I'll do the dishes, or, you know, I'll get up and stretch.
Yeah. Yeah.
It depends on the day.
That's a great common denominator. What is the outcome I need for today?
Yeah. And then you have to be okay with not reaching that outcome. You have to give yourself to be a human being and miss goals.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like if you set a goal for a day to write for 2 hours, which is what I try to do, 2 hours a day and 20-minute sprints with breaks in between. But if I set that goal and I can't get to it because, you know, my newsletter and the people in my newsletter need my attention, then I have to be okay with not making the goal that I wanted to write that 2 hours.
Yeah.
because other things do have precedence at times.
Maybe it's about a commitment to the intention rather than a reliance on meeting the goal to satisfy some sort of self-esteem, you know.
Exactly. Like, I can feel good about myself and my writing as long as I am okay with being human as well.
That makes great sense. And so, silly thing I like to ask at the end, or close to the end of each episode, when I have these conversations, if you could take everything that you've taken in, everything that you've experienced, the expertise that you've gathered across your creative writing life, and distill it down to a bumper sticker or something on a coffee mug, what do you think that might be?
Okay. So I have an Octavia Butler quote for that. The big talent is persistence. I believe that, you know, so much about writing and publishing is working through a really emotional, like, churn. You're told often that you're not good enough, that you're not in the market at the right time, or just getting rejected straight up. And we're told this stuff all the time. And it takes a lot of persistence. Like, you have to persist through that emotional, like, those shots through the heart, basically. Yeah, right?
Absolutely.
So, you know, I got this fortune cookie the week before I signed my trilogy contract, and I still have it somewhere. I swear I do. I have a picture of it on my, like, Instagram or something like that. And it says, if you can shape it in your mind, you will find it in your life. Ever since, you know, I've been kind of pushing and striving to get books written, to get them to get them into the next steps, published or an agent, and to eventually be seen and accepted as a professional author, to get that validation that we talked about, right? And ever since I got this fortune cookie, I have just been, I can envision what I want in my life. And maybe I will eventually get it, and maybe I won't. But in order to get what I want, I have to persist. I have to keep moving. I have to persevere through being torn apart emotionally. And then I have to learn how to put myself back together. And I think that is kind of the human existence anyway. But when you're a creator and you're being told that, you know, your art isn't for someone, on a frequent basis, especially if you're querying agents, you have to really be okay with the pain and the disappointment, and you have to be able to put yourself back together and move on from that. Like, if I want a career in publishing, I have to keep going. I have to keep writing, and I have to keep putting it out there. And persistence, you know, it's one foot in front of the other, despite all that hardship. And without it, I really don't know anyone who could survive in this industry. And I certainly personally wouldn't be able to.
So, two thoughts. First of all, I wonder if Octavia Butler was thinking about a pretty well-known quote from James Baldwin.
Talent is insignificant. I know a lot of talented ruins. Beyond talent lie all the unusual words, discipline, love, luck, but most of all, endurance.
Yep, you found the quote. Or you had the quote, like, already.
No, I'm just really actually quite good at Googling quickly.
Yeah, well, and that's it, right? You know, I was just, again, in another recent conversation, the subject of the noble delusion came up. The idea that writers have to believe in themselves relentlessly, and contrary in many cases, contrary to what the rest of the world is telling them, mm-hmm. you know, in order to, again, persevere, to persist. No, I think that's great. And I love, the Octavia Butler distillation, of the Baldwin quote, intentional or not. You know, she managed to say in 5 words the exact same thing.
Leave it to Octavia Butler to be able to do that. Though, yeah. Right?
Indeed, indeed. Well, this has been fantastic. Is there anything that we, in the course of the conversation, that maybe we didn't cover, or that you thought, oh, I wanted to expand on this or that or the other thing, that we didn't get around to?
No, you're actually really good at getting me to think and move. And I noticed this when I listened to some of your other podcasts. You're good at prompting thought and conversation. So I think I got what all I needed to get out, is what I'm trying to say.
Wonderful. No, I thank you for that. That's kind of you to say. And I'm glad to hear it. You know, that's the idea, right? Is to listen more and speak less, and allow for that space, because if you have a little bit of silence, like, your brain's going to go a little further.
Exactly.
No, I thought this was great. And, you know, my goal with these conversations is to provide something that writers and other creative folks can come to whenever. By the time, you know, it might be March, it might be June, it might be 2026 when they hear this conversation, you know, it doesn't matter how long it's been out. My goal is that no matter when it's heard, there's something of value for the people hearing it. And I think we accomplished that, in spades. So thank you for that.
I'm definitely not an expert on anything. Like, I do not like to style myself as an expert. But I love talking about my process and how things worked for me. And that's what this conversation was.
Yeah. And that's, it's just like the writing itself, right? We don't know what kind of impression or what kind of effect or impact it's going to have on the people taking it in. But I think it will, one way or the other. So AJ Super, thank you so much for being on Sonatotum.
And thank you so much for having me.
Well, there you have it, my friends. There's our conversation with AJ Super. As always, I hope that you found some value in that, hearing another author's perspective, another writer's perspective on making stuff and finding success as they define it, and staying healthy and sane in the process. I liked their bumper sticker slogan about persistence. That could go on a mug, right? And hey, as always, if you have anything that you would like to comment on about this conversation or any other episode of Sonatotum, as always, you can go to mattselznick.com, click on the podcast button there, look for this episode, episode 101, and just leave a comment there. You can also email me directly at matt@mattselznick.com. And if you like, you could even record a little voice message, maybe on your phone, and email that to matt@mattselznick.com. And if you do that with the voice message, I may play it in a future episode, and we'll have a little time-shifted conversation. Either way, I will reply to your comments and your emails and your smoke signals and your semaphore, however you like to get a hold of me. I want to thank the Multiversalist patron members who help support this show with their monthly and annual pledges. Thank you, as always, to Zoe Lay, to J.C. Hutchins, to Jim Lewinson, to Amelia Bowen, to Ted Leinhart, and to Charles Eugene Anderson. You guys are amazing. You help offset the cost and the time and the effort that goes into creating Sonatotum and supporting my other creative endeavors. And in return, of course, my beloved member patrons, my gold and silver and bronze patron members, they get a bunch of perks and bonuses for their support. If you'd like to find out more, please visit mattselznick.com/B-A-patron. mattselznick.com/B-A-patron. And by the way, Selznick is spelled S-E-L-Z-N-I-C-K. In 2 weeks, the next episode will be a solo episode where I'll be talking about what's going on in my recent creative life and creative writing life, and hopefully presenting that in such a way that whatever has been going on with me, I can turn into a teaching moment for you, even if it's maybe just a commiserating moment that we share. I'll also have lots of news about my latest release that's available in ebook and audiobook, and by the time you listen to this, limited edition, handmade, autographed chapbook edition as well. We'll talk about that in depth in 2 weeks, but of course you can go to mattselznick.com and find out all about it there as well. All right. I hope you take a moment to visit ajsuper.com and check out their works. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with AJ. And yeah. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. Take care.